Write your dreams down, they say, and then pursue them. Run at them. You can do anything you want to do. How often have you heard that? I'm not sure about you. I get the sort of idea of it, that, you know, you've got to work hard, and things are better off when you work hard. There's no doubt about that. But when you hear statements like you can be anything you want to be, I'm like, well, you know, I'm like 6'3", dude. I can't be a ballerina. I can't be a gymnast. I'm not, you know, there is sort of these moments where you're like, this doesn't make sense, right? But there's also moments where actually as we pursue and as we go hard at our goal, even when it doesn't happen, it does turn up great and good things. And in a roundabout way, it has the same sort of impact. That's the story we're going to hear today on today's edition of the Towards Understanding podcast with Jason T. Smith, author of the book Unlikely, the man behind the Back in Motion company. He's going to share with us his heart and his passion to head down one particular avenue, and it just seemed like he could not get there until eventually he realized, oh, maybe I'm doing this just in a different form. Maybe you feel a bit like that. Before we get stuck into this interview, would you rate, review, share this with others? It helps us get out there just that bit more. All right, let's listen to our conversation that I had with Jason T. Smith. G'day, Jason.
Thank you for having me, Clayton.
It's so, so good to have you in. And, you know, we're not joking when you write your memoir. This is a big book, Unlikely. I mean, you went for it. You
well,
know?
You know, I joke if you don't like reading it, it can double as a kitchen step to the high cupboards or a monitor stand or something of that usefulness.
Oh, I love that. Let's get into this because there's so much to talk through. And I am fascinated with your journey, but it's interesting because I'm not fascinated by just your business journey, right? There is so much in that. We want to touch off on it, but I think you've got a uniqueness about you which says, I want to bring in my faith in all of what I do in business. And often perhaps we don't hear that enough. And that's the thing that really fascinates me about your journey. So let's maybe start with the faith aspect of it. When for you was, hey, my relationship with Jesus was actually a really important part of my life. When did that happen?
I had a really defining moment when I was 10 years old. And so a lot of people might think that a naive young boy who should be playing skateboards and Ataris, if anyone remembers those computer games, what's he doing having a profound spiritual experience? But really, that's what happened. And both my parents came to faith at about the same time. And I write about this in the book, Mum first, Dad a little later. And I have my own unique experience with God somewhere in the middle. Yeah. And it, in a way, started watching the cartoons on a Saturday morning and seeing these World Vision ads, which were a new genre, really, of trying to compel people to give a dollar a day for the plight of the really poor and needy. And as a young boy, I'm almost traumatized by what I'm watching on TV as I see these impoverished kids. And I make a deal with God. I basically pledge to him that I want to become a doctor and work amongst the poorest of the poor, that these people must mean something to him. And it began an awareness of a God and an encounter that really I couldn't deny, even if I didn't have words to describe it. And I feel like God revealed himself to me in ways that have remained true.
Yeah. So it's this interesting, as we're going to hear in your journey, that this moment of understanding a God who is real mixed with this idea of changing the world for something better, in a sense, is sort of a constant for you. And we're going to hear that throughout your whole story. It's sort of been a part of your understanding of faith.
It probably has been. And I wouldn't have necessarily done the alloy of those two until I reflect back on my story. So it wasn't a present understanding at the time. And I don't even know if it's always a healthy composite, because you want to relate to God in a way that is sincere and true and authentic, and not confuse it with the ambition of wanting to become somebody or do something that might be some of your own making. And I think for me, it's been, well, nearly 50 years of running those two lines in parallel, trying to differentiate how much of this is God and how much of my life is me, wanting to dial me down and dial him up and try and find the right balance.
We're just going to skim over so many parts of your story. That's why there's the book, right? For people to get in and dig in deeper to it. But this passion and this heart started driving you too, right? You said, oh, I want to be a doctor. We read in the book too that, you know, you worked really hard. You really put your mind to it. But those scores didn't come. And ended up finding that you could get into physiotherapy. And you went, well, okay, I'll do that. Was that with a begrudging sort of attitude? All right, we'll do that. Or, okay, well, this is the next step. Let me still step into this space.
I think the day that I found out that I missed out on medical school would be one of the lowest points in my journey. And there's been plenty to choose from. And so it gives you an insight, I think, into the devastation, you know, the evaporation of a dream, the sense that everything I'd been working for a decade in already only my short life,
yes.
You know, I'm sort of 18 years of age at that point. I just saw it crumble and my identity with it. Because in my mind, everybody who I'd ever talked to, everybody who I'd shared my aspiration with knew that this is what I'd put my heart to. Becoming a doctor. And physiotherapy didn't feel like a slight variation. It felt like a poor second choice, but my next best option. And it took me at least a year, I think, to reconcile that. But God, in his goodness, he helped me fall in love with physiotherapy. So by my end of second year, I got the opportunity to transfer into medicine. And forfeited that because I was now hook, line and sinker committed to physio, knowing it was a vehicle for a lot of what I had intended the medical pathway to provide.
And one of the things that is a theme throughout your life, and we see it in the book too, is this idea that says, well, right, this is how I'm now going to get overseas and help people. Like just like back to that World Vision ad that you saw as a 10-year-old, I'm going to go over, all right, I'm going to do physio, I'm going to go from there. And so you continue on, you get through uni, you know, high marks throughout it all. And then, right, how are we going to do this next steps? And it just seems like that despite your praying, despite your, hey, God, this is it, I'm ready to go, he kept wanting to bring you back to something that was based here in Australia. So how did it end up being that you're like, right, okay, I'm going to actually settle with that fact early on, I suppose, that I'm actually supposed to start, you know, running my own sort of, you know, physiotherapy clinics here.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds disrespectful and I don't mean it that way, but I often describe that God railroaded me in to a life of suburbia in Melbourne.
Yeah.
In those intervening years, I'd met Paulina, who became my wife. She was an intensive care nurse. We both had a passion to serve the poor. And I thought, what a package for any mission agency, for any humanitarian project. You've got a physio, you've got a nurse, we're young, we're fit, we're willing, we're able. And we did a few short-term trips, but none of them converted into those long opportunities. And so, you know, there's a scripture in the Bible and it says the harvest is plentiful and the workers are few, which kind of paints this picture that there's a lot of need out there, but not enough people willing to go. And it would frustrate me because we were willing. We seem to be the opposite to this little passage, this poetic verse in the Bible. But it seemed like God had left us on the shelf. And I got to say, it was hard because I felt like I didn't qualify. I felt like there must be something wrong with me. God didn't want us. We weren't worthy or noble enough for that cause. And staying home and working for a living, you know, which sounds you know, pretty vanilla, but staying home and getting a job in a public hospital and then eventually starting our own practice felt like punishment. It really felt like I had failed. And I often do say, a little tongue-in-cheek now, but my career started as a failed medical missionary. I resigned from various jobs because I felt so unfulfilled. And it seemed like the only path forward was to treat friends and family for a bit of pocket money to pay the mortgage from the carport at home until God eventually realized we were his, you know, his ticket to saving the world. Of course, he doesn't need me.
Yeah.
He wants me, but he doesn't need me.
Yeah. And this aspect of, right, okay, so it is your own sort of little practice out of the carport. And then it sort of just keeps building, but it's not just by accident, right? There's moments where clearly a part of your story is that you have a natural business acumen that occurs, but you have a lot of hard work in who you are. You also see opportunities of this could be better. that something more could happen here. Just because that's the way it's always been done, it doesn't need to be. And these sort of, as I read your story and understand more of you, Jason, it seems like these three things keep colliding together, and then you add in your faith. That this is sort of what is the driving force from what this becomes, this sort of carport one, to suddenly being a bit more, you know, professional, as it were, and then actually maybe do we start actually franchising this out? Now, that seems a long leap and seems far, far away again from the medical missionary overseas aspect of it. So take us on that. Was there a moment in that period of time where you went, okay, I'm now doing this and this is part of God's plan? Or was it always still, well, this is just the next thing until he's going to tap us on the shoulder?
And yeah. I shouldn't have called the book unlikely. I should have called it one big fat accident after another, because none of this was planned. None of this is my genius. Yeah. There was no blueprint. It's exactly as you described, Clayton. It's like God just kept revealing another opportunity. We took another step. And I can distinctly recall an evening late at night. I'm lying in bed. Paulina's lying next to me. She's already turned out the light and rolled over and gone to sleep. And I am reading a ANZ brochure, a bank brochure, on all the requirements to start a franchise. And I remember being so disillusioned by how much compliance and rigor and complexity there was in this business model that I, not in anger, but more in resignation, just threw the booklet onto the floor, and I hit something and I made a noise, and Paulina woke up and she turns over and says, "Is everything okay? What's going on?" And I just remember turning to her and saying, "Oh, it's okay. I've just decided we're never going to franchise." And, you know, these are the famous last words that I keep repeating all through my sordid career. You know, I'm never going to start a business. I'm never going to run a franchise. We're never going to go interstate. I'm never going to borrow money, you know. And you find God leading you to the cliff edge and the brink. And it is a combination of faith and a sense of your destiny and purpose. And that if God is in this, who are we to deny it? And so you jump and away you go again. It's just an adventure after another.
Yeah. Now, what that became was back in motion. I mean, it was that technically from the start, but then as it built, and many, many people around both Australia and New Zealand might know of Back in Motion. It's this remarkable organisation that was, as you said, franchised. How many in the end did you end up having practices?
We peaked at 140 locations with about 700 people wearing our brand. And I think at our absolute height, where we had aggregated with some other businesses, which is jumping ahead, we had up to 10% of the Australian population on our database as a client.
Just remarkable, isn't it? So, you know, this is where we're going to end here in terms of, you know, from the business part. There's plenty of other questions we've got coming. But you said, all right, I'm not going to do franchising, but here you are. You end up doing this and you're stepping through it. So along that way, as you kept saying, all right, well, I think this is what God's got. So, now we are actually going to do this. Mm. And we are going to get involved in all that compliance. And we are going to do all of these things. Is there moments along that way that you're like, oh, I'm just going to throw it in now? Or is it always, now I'm in it. I've got to see this all the way through.
Yeah. There's a pragmatic answer and there's a philosophical answer. The pragmatic answer is I am a workhorse. I don't consider myself very smart, but I am prepared to break through barriers with just grunt and street fight. And the pragmatic view would be, when I made my bed, I had to lie in it. So once we had agreed to run this national business, and we had taken on debt funding, and we had, you know, employed hundreds of people, and they had mortgages, there's a bit in me that just says I'm never going to lie down and die. But I think the more philosophical response is that God changed me along the way, and he opened my eyes to his greater plan. And whilst I couldn't see it from the beginning, and in fact couldn't see its totality even until the end, and I looked back, there was this quiet peace that kept assuring me that God is in this. And there was lots of uncertainty, but the next step was the right step. And I had a beautiful man come alongside me really early in the journey and just walk this whole 20 years with me. And so he was more than a mentor. Not really a business coach, but he was like a soul coach. You know, he loved God deeply, had his own experiences in business, and he taught me. really four iterations, if I quickly lay them out for you. Firstly, I thought it was business or ministry, business or missions, and it was a choice between the two. Then he helped me realize it was business and missions. I can do both, like have parallel lives, and this was exciting for me. You kind of then move on to thinking business for mission. So as we succeed and build the war chest, we can fund work I could never actually personally be involved in. That's fulfilling. That's meaningful. But eventually I got to this place of understanding business is mission. That actually the people I work with every day, the workforce, the client base, the industry that I'm in, I need to actually represent God and heaven in that space, and that actually fueled me. You know, that made me want to get up every day, keep going to work, push through the hardship and not give up.
It's unfair. It's been 15 minutes. We pretty much covered this whole part. And the reason I've done that is because there's so many other things we want to dig into on different aspects. So we're trying to give an overview, especially in our first sort of part of the conversation. We're going to come back with Jason a little while to ask a bit more. But just before we do go to our first break here too, wanted to talk about the way that you felt along this journey from, I want to be overseas doing this to, and now it's not the medical, it's the physio to, now I'm not franchised, I am, and now I'm running this massive thing, and I'm all of these people who are expecting a whole lot of things from me, both in sort of a national office that you've got, and then all those who are franchised. You know, it's this remarkable network that one little moment here and there can just trip up everything else, right, along the way, as we certainly read in your book, which we'll get to some of those. I'm wondering about your different interactions with God through that. Do you see that God was working differently with you, or were you working differently with God in each of those iterations as it went, or is that an unfair dichotomy?
I think I haven't quite thought of it in those terms before, but I think the honest answer would have to be both. That God is so gracious and gentle and understanding of wherever I was at along the journey, that he was able to shape shift a little and approach me at different angles and bring me different convictions around what he wanted me to learn in those moments. He's more than just a one message God. He has, you know, he's a master communicator. So he was able to tailor his message in such a way that I would hear it at different times along the path, which meant he looked different at different phases. But the great miracle in this whole story isn't that God changes, because he's ultimately unchangeable, right? He is everything we need him to be. It's that I changed. Is that he kept helping me pivot and ultimately concede to what he needed me to become in those moments. And so I look at it really and think, wow, my conversation with God over 20 years has got deeper, it's got richer. In some ways, it's got simpler as well. And he has arrested my attention on so many moments where I thought I understood something, and he revealed a truth that showed me I had never seen the fullness of what he was doing. So it's a relationship like any other. Like, it gets deeper and richer with time, but we relate differently over that time. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, it's good. It's good.
But I would say both of us.
Yeah. We're sort of trying to do a bit of a summary of it, and then we're going to deep dive a bit more in some specific areas. But the last part of this part with Back in Motion is that actually, after all of this work, and then, as you describe beautifully in the book, Unlikely Too, you just set a new vision of what you wanted to do. And then suddenly there was all these offers to buy the business, which in the end you did step forward in, and, you know, some crazy, you know, expectations that what you had originally set and then what actually happened was so far above that, which was unbelievable, the offers that came in. And you did actually end up selling that as well. Which I think is also an interesting other aspect, right? That here you are, you feel like this is what God's got you on, this is the plan, and then suddenly you've got to let it go. So I want to ask an identity question around that, that says, how do you, after all of this time, that it almost feels like you were trying to say, this is my identity, God, I'm going to go and do this, and then for ages he kept saying, no, I want you to do this, I want you to do this, I want you to be this, and then suddenly that's not there.
Yeah.
How did you deal with the identity question, or did you not? And you're like, actually, I was completely prepared for that, and I had no problems. I wasn't holding on to that as part of who I was.
I think the identity thematic follows us through the journey of life. I don't think you're ever done on that question, because God's wanting to tell us who he made us to be, and we're trying to remind him who we want that story to look like, or what we want it to look like. And I think it's reconciling that moment by moment right through the journey. You're right, I had launched a 2030 vision inside the network. I had gone big and bold. I was talking about 10xing our growth, expanding into all new territory with new services. I had put it all out there. And within 2.5 years of making that bold declaration, I was a nobody. Like, we had completely divested our holdings in that group. And Paulina and I always felt it was never our business to sell. Mm. It was a kingdom asset. It was part of God's redemptive plan for our life and other people's lives. And we were stewards, and we just needed to caretake it on his behalf. And so coming to the decision to sell was big in lots of ways that we might get into later. But from an identity point of view, I had to dissociate. I had to appreciate that God didn't need me in that business anymore, which means he must have another assignment, an alternate purpose. And this was him going the long way round for 20 years. It wasn't about he needing a national health brand. He went the long way round to develop in me and my heart some dependencies on him that must be necessary for the next season. And I make that sound simple because I say it quickly. Actually, that's big, it's painful, it's deep, and I'm still working through it 3 years on.
Yeah. And so to provide some context as we sort of finish the first part of the context of your story too, that this, and you know, it's the byline on the book too, that we went from this startup in the carport to actually the brand being valued at over $100 million right at the end of your time there, which is truly a remarkable aspect. And again, it's not all about the money or the value of it. It's in terms of finances, but the aspect of the journey that you've been on. Mm. My guest is Jason T. Smith, the author of this book, Unlikely, as well as a number of other books, but this is the most recent one. We're going to be back with him in a couple of minutes' time. We are going to start deep diving on a few more things. What is those next steps? How do we move to another identity? We want to talk about that. I want to talk about vulnerability that he shares and why he does some of that, as well as family and exhaustion. Those aspects we want to dig into parts of your story next here on Towards Understanding.
Share your brand, your event, your message.
Across 90 Christian radio stations and major cities in Australia and New Zealand.
By sponsoring Towards Understanding, hosted by Clayton Bielan.
More than 210,000 people tune into Towards Understanding each week. And with just one sponsorship, you'll reach this immense engaged audience. Find out more about this exciting and unique opportunity now
on the sponsorship page at positivemedia.com.au.
Can I talk firstly about family? Mm. One of the things I see in your book is that you are, as you already indicated, a hard worker, and you're willing to put in the hard yards. Mm. There was a sense as I read it that I'm like, how's your family going at this moment? How are you going with that one? And there was oftentimes you dip back to the family aspects of it. But I'm just wondering, because I think there is always this tension, both in business, in life, even sometimes people when they're, you know, working in their church, volunteering, where sometimes we end up this weird balancing act that so many people try and understand between whatever the thing is and family. For you, what was there moments that you go, I think I actually nailed that well, or I could have done that better?
I am, for people who are listening, I'm shaking my head at the question, because, you know, the three themes of this book are faith, family, and franchising, the three dirty F words, right? And I couldn't tell the story without being honest about the shortfalls, the tensions, and sometimes the breakthroughs that Paulina and I would have experienced as we tried to navigate business and family. And so I would have to admit right off the top, I got it wrong a lot. I really did. But Paulina and I, we learned to embrace the tension of what some people colloquially might refer to as work-life balance or home ministry balance. I don't like that term. I think it sets them up as opposites.
Yep.
Actually, they're an integrated whole. I can accept ratio. You know, yep. There's a ratio in our lives. But we would.
I often use the word synergy, work-life synergy. Like sometimes like work has to have more, sometimes life has to have more. And it has to go up and down.
Anyway, you know, Jesus and the apostles, they model not perfect 50-50 balance.
That's right.
And so there's seasons. But we also can't use that language as a get-out-of-jail-free card to become reckless and disproportionate and to obviously violate our family values. And so Paulina held me very accountable over that 20 years. She is a strong, resilient woman. She has convictions. Home is very important to us both. She knew I valued family, but I relied on her so often, more than I cared to admit at the time, to hold my feet to the fire. Because there is a noisy, noisy world out there, people pulling me in all sorts of directions. And she would often remind me, you have 700 people screaming for your help, for your attention, wanting more from you. And for her to get the family's attention, for her to get me back focused on home, she had to at least equal that noise. Mm. So that meant there was some conflict, there was some tension. But I think of it as really positive tension, positive force. Of course, in the moment, it doesn't always go down that well. But as we reflect on those moments, we would learn, hey, this is good. We need to keep pushing, fighting for family.
Yep.
And I'm pretty honest in the book where I got that wrong. And I think hopefully people see some strategies of how we started to right that ship.
Yeah, that certainly does come through. I suppose I also just want to push a bit more, because I especially think of someone who's maybe going, I've done a bit of that and now I'm living in a regret of, you know, I'm never going to get that time back with the family there or whatever else it might be. I want to fix it. And so, okay, the future's going to be a bit better, but there's an aspect of it. Mm. Have you ever gone through that aspect yourself of, oh, did I regret some of that and what do I do with that?
Yeah, I think you can only move forward. You can only own the moment and move forward. You can salvage lessons from the past. You just can't change it. So I would give people a little bit of reprieve from beating themselves up over lost moments and accept that today's a new day.
Yeah.
I would actually start with the people you feel you want to make good on, those relationships you want to double down and invest more into. I would start by just using language that owns some of the missed opportunity. Let them hear you say you want to make a greater investment into the future, and then put some rigor around that. I mean, literally set some ground rules, put some accountabilities in place, allow people to call you out on it, and be very practical about that. So diarize it if you need to, you know, put boundaries around you.
Yeah, love that. Let's stay with Paulina especially, because she is clearly a hero in this book, and that's lovely to see. But I think also there's moments where I'm like, man, Jason, would you just listen to her more, please? And I think especially around the vulnerability that you actually showed in that. And there's multiple times where you're very honest about people who are really trying to rip you off, who are doing a dodge to you personally or to the business. And it seems like, you know, in one sense, to your credit, right, the empathy you have for that person, everyone else might be saying, and then a Paulina especially is like, I think they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes. And it's like, every time you're like, no, I'm sure it's
give
good.
Him one more give chance, him one more chance, Clayton. Give and, him one more
and
chance.
It did get by the end. I was like, man, I'm impressed with this guy's vulnerability. But I'm also like, hold on. She said it again and you didn't listen again.
You're not the first person to be making this this observation, Clayton, that I'm a slow learner. I've earned a PhD in naivete. That how could I be that gullible time after time? And people have said, literally reading the book, I am so frustrated with you, Jason. Would you just learn from the past chapter? But we don't live our lives like the book I've written. You don't actually have... It's like when we read the Bible, we think, oh, it was so easy for Joseph because, he went into a prison, but you know, only a few moments later, he's second in charge of all of Egypt. And we think, you didn't have to wait that long. No, it was years and years and years. So when you're living it, and this would be your listeners' experience, when you're living it, you often can't see the forest for that tree right in front of you. I am wrestling this idea of I want to serve the purposes of God, but I'm stuck in a commercial world with hard realities. And there's this tension of how much of me needs to be hard-nosed businessman and how much needs to be a compassionate capitalist. And where do I draw the line? And do I give people a second and third chance? Mm. And, you see some glaring examples of where I get it wrong in the book, and people do take advantage. But then I still sit back and I just think, God, you might have a purpose in that that I still can't see. At least it's humorous reading for everybody else. My wife gets to tell me, "I told you so," every other day of the year. And you just don't know what's happening in the human heart.
Yeah. There's sensational vulnerability in it, which I think we so misunderstand when we talk about our life story, that we need to share the vulnerable. And I'm not meaning it to be like, oh, I'm now sharing. You know, some people say, I'm going to share vulnerably. And then it's like, well, you're not, if you're even saying it right. Actually, the bad stuff that you've screwed up is so powerful. And so I thank you for sharing that. And I think that the connection I started putting with it is that your constant refrain, and you often refrain, and especially how you finish the book too, is around that this is about people. It's about people. And it feels like this is what you're doing in those moments, right? You're giving that person another, because it's about people. But then there's also this other build-up of, actually, it's right to have a bit of skepticism at times.
Yeah.
How do you frame what you mean by life, work, faith, living out our is about people first? What do you mean by that frame?
Well, it's actually something that took me a long time to accept, because by nature, I am task-driven. I am a list guy. I am all about conquering the next hill. And people, I understand they are contributors, but it's the objective that I'm chasing. And I can't explain why. This is part of my DNA, part of my wiring. And the world is divided into two camps. You know, there's people who are relationship first, and there are the rest of us who are very task orientated. And Paulina is relational, and I'm this opposite. And throughout the journey of business, I feel like one of God's clear objectives has been to teach me the other half of the picture. Yeah. Not to disregard the importance of having strategic intent, but to appreciate, at the end of the day, the only things that endure beyond this life are people.
Mm.
Not things, not brands, not bank accounts, not any of the legacy stuff that we like to sometimes point to as success. It is only people that have an eternal spirit. And so I have to put relationship first. So I think of it now as being a very people-centered or people-focused endeavor. All my assignments, I have to put people at the middle. And then I have to retrofit all my task and strategic objectives around it, knowing that they're meaningful and important, but not at the expense of people. And of course, you know, Clayton, I'm going to get that wrong still a lot of the time, because it's not my default. I have to intentionalize that.
Does that drive you nuts? And also to the perspective go, God, why did you, if this is so important, that this has to be a big key part and I have to actually learn to put this first, why have you allowed me to be the way I am?
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, people ask this question on a whole lot of different parts of their world, right? Why am I like this, God, if this is actually how you want to make me? Have you dwelt on that?
It drives me nuts. Yeah. It drives my wife nuts that I'm not more relationally driven. But I think we can learn it. We can actually put intentional steps in place to develop these appreciations. And so we're not off the hook, those of us who are more task-driven. But as far as why, God, would you make me the other way if this is central to your character, is because none of us have the completeness of God in us, right? We're a mosaic, and he needs everybody to play their part.
Good.
And in fact, the world does need a few doers, a few action heroes, a few people who are prepared to just run through a brick wall, head down, bum up, full charge. And it's just a matter of the composition, you know, the back to ratios. It's about when you let that emphasis be carried. Yeah. And I think God's working on us all in some respect.
As we talk about that people idea, one of the fascinating parts that you just touch on off in here, but you, in fact, you've written a whole book about it as well, Downside Up Leadership, which is around this idea that you actually got rid of titles in, now that's just one part of it. I know there's more parts of it, but you got rid of titles in your organization, which is you know, for many, it's like, what? How's this going to work?
Controversial.
Yep, you lost a few people from it as well. These sorts of ideas. Was that around the concept of people first, or was this more a business principle that you're wanting to run?
I think it's artificial to separate it, because there's this confluence of God's truth and human nature and commercial principles all coming together. Like, actually, truth is truth. And I realized people were hanging on to titles as some artificial sense of authority, that they could make people do stuff they didn't want to do simply because of the nameplate on their door or the qualifications in their resume. And that just isn't God's way. It's not how we should lead. We should serve. We should have a contest of ideas. The newest, youngest graduate physiotherapist who had just stepped on the job should be able to voice an opinion with safety about how we could do things better and differently. And me, as the founder and the guy who had always been there, shouldn't be able to trump in just because I had more money in the bank. Like, we needed creativity and innovation. And by detitling the organization meant that not everybody had the same responsibilities, but we allowed them to contribute with two things: what they loved and what they were good at.
Yeah,
and I think that actually unleashed, and the evidence would suggest, in that we grew our business. In the next 3 years, we doubled our organization in what had taken us 12 years earlier. And I think the cultural dynamic is an important part of that.
Yeah, it requires constant focus on people, right?
Wow.
Like you can't actually do it as soon as you take your eye off the ball there, then that won't work anymore.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
You need to be always thinking, how do I bring the best
yeah.
out of the people around me?
Yeah.
And that requires energy.
Yeah. 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 As we see your story and, you know, this idea of how you want to be missions focused, and then, you know, part of the final part of the, as you've sold back in motion, you're like, well, actually, there's a lot of money now sitting here, which we're able to put into a foundation, which actually then can keep going and supporting missionaries, right? Like, you are actually doing the thing that you felt like you should be doing. It's a different way, but it is there. There's also another part of your world that you've stepped into, which is around chairing halftime mm-hmm. as well. And you know, there's many other things that you're a part of, but I'm zoning in on this one, I suppose, because I think it's a good conversation within this space of talking about business and purpose and life and faith. Can you tell us a bit about halftime, and I suppose why it's important for you right now, and what's your message for others as you want them to think about what it means to be at halftime and what that might.
So halftime's an organization that initially started in the US. Bob Buford has a great story and his own book titled Halftime, which I would encourage your listeners to read. But it's now a ministry expression, or a facilitation of people in transition. So they could be career-minded, they can be mums in the home, they can be high-net-worth individuals divesting their businesses, but you are going through high-stake decisions that are changing the trajectory of your life, or offer that hope, and you don't know how to navigate change. And so we are helping people by coaching them through processes to really consider, what would God's best intentions for your life be as you look into the future, even with some uncertainty, so that you have courage to take the next step. And there's a little tagline, it's, you know, get clear, get free, get going. So get some clarity, free yourself up from some of the obligations of your past assignment, and then get going with whatever is new and fresh ahead of you. And there's a notion of parallel careers even, that you might not just do one thing. That as you move into the second half of your life, you have skills and talents and finances that enable you to maybe do a multiple range of things. And so we're seeing some incredible stories come out of this space.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Often people have been through a pretty intense period of life that, you know, it was 20 years where your world was focused on Back in Motion. What it is, it's been a few years now, but there's a period of, hey, like, I need to step back for a bit. I need to just take a moment and find that. Have you found what your next one is? Like, do you know what you think that call is? Or is it the same call that God's always had? It's just going to be shaped differently for you.
So Paulina made me commit as we signed the sale contracts. She said, Jace, I need you to say no to every opportunity for at least the next 12 months.
That's good.
And it was agony, Clayton. It was agony because I am so wired for the next thing, and there were so many invitations to do something, and we were cashed up and we could invest into all sorts of new possibilities. And Paulina just kept looking at me over the kitchen table, and she would say, as I would espouse the next iteration of possibility, she'd say, remember, it's a no. It's a no for a whole year, or at least a not yet.
Yep.
And so for probably 1 to 2 years, we've just been in what we've called our decompression bubble, as we've let God heal us from some things. Yeah, it was pretty intense. You know, the season, particularly as it concluded, we were exhausted. We wanted to double down on family. We wanted to, you know, look at each other and really make sure that the next adventure would be together and not taking us down separate tracks. And so we had a self-imposed sabbatical and really used that time to just refresh and let God speak to us, you know, without all the noise. And I think that's been super healthy. And then there's this kind of second innings now where we're starting to drop low-cost probes. So if you think of the oil rigs, they don't bring in the big drills until they know they're going to strike oil. They just do lots of little pilot holes. So we're dabbling in different things. We're getting our charitable trust up and running. We're supporting some amazing projects where people on the ground are carrying the weight of that responsibility. Great. I'm chairing halftime. I've got a few investments. We're not bored and we're not passive, but we're low-cost probes. We're just doing pilot holes. And the prayer really is, God, when you have the next big thing you want us to wholly commit to, you know we'll be ready, we'll be healthy, and we're waiting. Mm-hmm. And I think between here and there, we serve other people's visions. Yeah. And that's okay. You know, I've spent 20 years running hard down one line. It's good to serve other people's mission and just help where we can.
Yeah, love that. Jason, thanks for being so honest today and having a chat with us in the book as well. We appreciate that. And hopefully, as we said, you know, the name of our program is Towards Understanding, that somebody who's perhaps living a life of faith and in business can take something from you. So maybe someone who is not quite sure about faith and that understanding has heard your passion and how faith can actually, doesn't stop you from doing what life is. It's actually integral to it and a huge part of it. So we thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. And to all your listeners, just encourage them, live on purpose, not by accident.
Yeah, love that. Jason T. Smith, author of this book, Unlikely, and we've got 5 copies to give away right now. So the first 5 who head to our website, towardsunderstanding.com.au, connect in with our team there and say, look, I'd like a copy of that book. We will get that to you. So head there right now, towardsunderstanding.com.au.